Hello and welcome to Cooper Talks. And in this episode, I'm going to go a bit old school, a bit back in time from what I've done before, and look at the reign of Henry VIII. So the first of a series of podcasts giving an overview of his life and what he did and the significance of various aspects of it. So who was Henry VIII? Well, to start this, I'm going to go back to before his reign and consider the situation that he found himself in. So Henry was born the second son of Henry VII, Henry Tudor, in June 1491 at Greenwich Palace. Now, there's a couple of significant things there. First of all, his father had won the throne at the Battle of Bosworth, and his claim was pretty ropey. There were a lot of people who had stronger claims to it, but he'd won it by dint of conquest, and he then married Elizabeth of York, who was the eldest daughter of Edward IV, who was kind of the last recognised Yorkist king. Richard III did take over, but he was seen as a usurper. So by marrying Elizabeth of York, Henry VII had improved his legitimacy and united the houses of York and Lancaster. But it's worth bearing in mind that when he came to the throne, England had been going through a long period of effective civil war and chaos in the Wars of the Roses that had devastated England. And although Henry VII claimed legitimacy by right of conquest, his claims by blood and inheritance were pretty ropey. And that meant that throughout his reign and throughout the early years of Henry VIII's lifetime, there were lots of challenges to his legitimacy and very real threats that he could be usurped. Now as the second son, Henry VIII, or Prince Henry in this early stage, was kind of left to his mother's devices. So he was raised at Eltham Palace by his mother, and she took charge of his education, appointing a tutor, John Skelton, to teach him his letters, and inviting scholars like Erasmus, who was like the rock and roll academic of the day, humanist scholar from the Netherlands, and Thomas More to come and teach and instruct the young prince. And they gave a very cultured education to him, and one with lots of ideas about religion and philosophy and arts, and a lot of Renaissance thinking and humanist influences coming through. Very different from his older brother, Arthur, who'd been sent off to Ludlow Palace and invested as Prince of Wales, very much as an apprenticeship to becoming king. Henry didn't have that. He was left a lot freer and so was a bit more independent-minded. Now, during all this, it's worth bearing in mind that those threats that I mentioned keep coming back time and time again during Henry VII's reign. And so there is this constant fear that the Tudor dynasty will be cut short and, you know, Henry VIII and Arthur will be displaced. The most serious of these happened when Henry was just a boy by a guy called Perkin Warbeck. Now, whether Warbeck was legitimately related to the Yorkist claimants is under some dispute. But the Yorkists, who'd felt that they'd been usurped by Henry VII, certainly backed him. The most notable name here was Margaret of York, who was the Duchess of Burgundy, well, the Dowager Duchess of Burgundy, should say, and was Edward IV's younger sister. And she claimed that Perkin Warbeck was actually Richard, Duke of York, one of the two nephews murdered in the Tower by Richard III, according to history. And, you know, lots of people dispute that, but let's just go. He almost certainly wasn't Richard, Duke of York. Richard, Duke of York was certainly murdered in the Tower. Who did it is a matter of some conjecture. But the fact that she backed Perkin Warbeck gave legitimacy to the claim. And was a very serious threat to the Tudor dynasty, so much so that Henry VII actually knighted his three-year-old son, Henry, and made him Duke of York and had him parade through the streets to show that, no, this is the real Duke of York. This person is an imposter. But it shows, the fact that he did it shows the seriousness of the threat and also the vulnerability of the Tudor claims. Now, later on, there'd be another battle against Perkin Warbeck. That was 3 years later in 1497. So much so that in this sort of mini skirmish in civil war, Henry was actually in danger and had to be hidden by his mother in the Tower of London. So it's worth bearing that in mind if you study Henry VIII in any detail, that in his early formative years, his father and his whole family's position was under constant threat, and very real threat, from Yorkist challengers. So he grew up with that fear and that lack of security, and that's going to have an impact on his reign and how he responds to criticism and threats to his power. Now, I mentioned that he already had some considerable scholars. Obviously, Thomas More, John Skelton and Erasmus were high-level educators. And one of the funny things is that Henry, quite early on, seemed to have a sense of his own grandeur and his own coming importance, which is unusual. He was a second son. But Erasmus, once he'd cobbled together a gift of poets and so on, poems that he'd written for Henry, gave the inscription suggesting that Henry, by patronising literature and the arts, could follow in the footsteps of Alexander the Great. And there's two interesting sides to that. One, the idea that Henry should promote literature, the arts and culture, putting in the mind of this young man that he should be a Renaissance prince and not someone just obsessed with war and conquest and rule, but someone who should be refined and educated in the classical tradition. But also the advice and impression that Henry was destined to follow in the footsteps of great men like Alexander the Great, who would be a colossus in history. Whether it's cause or effect is a matter of some debate. You know, didn't Erasmus write that inscription because he saw Henry's ego at a young age? Or was it ideas like that that would make Henry have a grandiose sense of his own importance and standing in history? We'll never know, but it's an interesting idea, I think, to make. Now, the next sort of big stage, gradually as a second son, Henry's doing his own thing, but he's being given a few official duties to do. One of which is to accompany Catherine of Aragon when she arrives in England to and from the wedding ceremony with his older brother Arthur. Now, that marriage was obviously quite important for the Tudor dynasties. It was a way of securing their legitimacy in a potential European alliance in the event of a sort of Yorkist uprising. So at this stage, King Ferdinand of Aragon, Queen Isabella of Castile had unified those two major Spanish kingdoms and were really important and wealthy figures on the European political scene. So by having Catherine marry, having their second daughter Catherine marry Arthur, it creates a dynastic link between the two and means if anything should happen that might jeopardise Catherine's claim to the throne, Henry could expect Ferdinand and Isabella to come to his support. So it's quite a diplomatic coup for him there. Perhaps what's more entertaining here is that at the wedding party afterwards, at the celebration, the young Henry himself, he's only about 12, 13 at the time, got a little bit carried away and sort of ripped off his clothes and jerkins and danced extravagantly, which was pretty scandalous, but I basically think sums up Henry's character. It was all there. Not sure what Catherine made of it herself at the time, but hey ho. So, one of the things that had been going on around the time of the wedding between Catherine and Arthur was that the Delapoles, who were probably the strongest legitimate claimants to the Yorkist line, so they had been Earls of Suffolk. Edmund Delapole and his brother Richard would flee England because they were worried that they would be persecuted or executed by Henry. So the Delapoles, quite a chunk of the family remain in England, but Edmund and Richard, as they're on their travels around Europe, will be a potential source of rebellion, a figurehead that could challenge Henry VII and then Henry VIII later on. And that was, you know, a serious blight and threat to the Tudor dynasty once again. As if that wasn't bad enough, in 1502, Arthur died. Now, Henry and Arthur had never been close. They'd never really grown up together. But this So Henry didn't really mourn him, but it dramatically transformed Henry's fortunes because he now becomes the heir to the throne. But it's not only going to change his fortunes, it's also going to change his lifestyle. So as a result of being elevated to heir to the throne, Henry VII brings him under his control and restricts his freedoms of movement. He changes his education to make it a much higher standard and much more kingly. And Henry VII decides he's going to keep Henry VIII close to him to instruct him in the ways of kingship. Now, shortly after, about 9 months, funnily enough, after Arthur's death, Henry's mother, who is devoted to Elizabeth of York, in trying to have a spare heir, gives birth to a daughter, Catherine, on this occasion, but she then dies, and this is devastating for Henry. He's absolutely devastated by it. This is Henry VIII. The daughter, Catherine, also dies, and this seems to have a transformative effect on Henry VII, the father, because he, all his worst characteristics come through at this point. He goes much more into himself, he becomes less predictable, he's much more austere, much more grumpy and moody. And Henry VIII seems to bear the brunt of this. Court becomes very drab, very dreary, a miserable place. Henry VIII, you know, this guy who's being artistic and celebrated and able to be his own man, suddenly has to obey a very strict and domineering father. Do as he's told, and the people comment he wasn't allowed to talk at court. He was kept in a room. The only way he could leave it was going through his father's court, constantly being policed and controlled, everything monitored, as he was trained by his father to be a traditional medieval king who kept out of European engagements and just secured his own throne. And this is going to have an impact on the way Henry will conduct himself once he inherits. The other thing that happens as a result of the collapse of, or the death of Arthur, is that Henry VII has a bit of an issue over what to do with Catherine of Aragon. He wants to keep the rather large dowry that had been sent, but there is about 6 year age gap between Catherine and Henry. Henry's still too young at this stage to legally marry. He's 12 at this time. The age of consent, if that makes sense, not sexual consent, but consent for marriage, for a boy at this time was 14. So Henry VII had Henry VIII marry Catherine of Aragon in order to keep the dowry, but he had to get a dispensation from the Pope. Now, this is all going to come back later, but he had to get this dispensation for the Pope in order to allow Henry to marry Catherine, because it was against canon law for someone to marry their dead brother's wife unless the Pope gave permission. Now, within all this permission came a bit of a thorny issue about whether or not the marriage had been consummated, and that means whether or not Arthur and Catherine had slept together. Now, Henry VII needed confirmation that the marriage had been consummated, because if it hadn't been consummated, then legally the marriage never took place and he would have to pay the dowry back to Ferdinand and Isabella. So he wanted to make sure the Pope confirmed that the marriage had been consummated, but also give permission for Henry to marry Catherine. And this is going to come back much later on. Catherine claims that it hadn't been consummated, and the Pope, according to later documents, does a bit of a fudge. He actually says it's for the sake of peace. He's going to allow it to happen. And he argues that, yeah, it probably was consummated. But it's all a bit vague and not very clear. And this is going to cause all sorts of legal problems later on. But for the time being, Henry and Catherine had married. But tellingly, it was a marriage that Henry could get out of. So because he was 12, he had 2 years to change his mind, because he wasn't old enough to consent to his marriage. And that's important, because at the same time as this, Isabella of Castile died, and their relation, her marriage to Ferdinand, was all that had unified the two kingdoms. So it wasn't clear yet whether the Spanish kingdom would remain unified. Joanna was their eldest daughter, and she was married to Philip of Burgundy, Duke of Burgundy, Philip the Handsome. So there's a bit of a claim for you. Anyway, they'd married... he was married to Joanna. And it was a question of whether he was going to fight for her claim as Queen of Castile and effectively make himself the ruler of Castile, or whether Ferdinand, her father, would continue to oversee and rule the two kingdoms. And this meant there was a very real danger that the Spanish alliance might fall apart. If it did, then Catherine becomes a less worthy bride and strategically less important. So Henry wanted to make sure that his son Henry VIII could wiggle out of this marriage at some future point. And that's why they were married, but there was this two-year wiggle room. And he also made sure that the marriage would not be consummated. Again, because until it's consummated, it's not actually happened, so Henry could get out of it. He actually went as far as making Henry give a statement declaring that, just before his 14th birthday, basically repudiating the wedding. So Henry VII made his son repudiate the wedding. So effectively, the wedding hadn't happened. And therefore, they were still betrothed, but Henry VIII could still marry someone else. So Catherine of Aragon will get stuck for several years in a kind of limbo situation here. Again, all of these politics in this early stage will come back to play later on. So in 1505... Henry VII is looking around for potential alternative allies who might be useful to him. And the most obvious one seems to be at this stage, Philip of Burgundy, Philip the Handsome, who is off to assert his and Joanna's claim to the throne of Castile. They're off to war to take on Ferdinand. And as it happens, that Yorkist rival, Edmund de la Pole, is in Philip of Burgundy's service. So this looks like a potential alliance and one where he could extradite, or Henry could ask to extradite de la Pole and deal with him at home to remove a potential rival. And as luck would have it, in January 1506, Philip and Joanna are involved in a shipwreck and end up landing in Dorset, at which point they're entertained and hosted by Henry VII and by Henry VIII. Now, what's important about this is the effect that seeing Philip of Burgundy has on the young Prince Henry. So at this stage, he's in this drab, austere, miserable, oppressive court of his father. And suddenly he's brought to the negotiations by his father with Philip of Burgundy. And Philip of Burgundy is about 27. He's very good looking, hence Philip the Handsome. He's very sporty. He's creative. He's everything that Henry wants to be. And it seems that this meeting left a lasting impression on Henry and set the tone for his future style of kingship. So this meeting and the way in which Philip would joust and take part in sports and music very much influenced Henry and his vision of what a king should be. And at the same time, they were admiring Arthur's Round Table at Winchester Cathedral, and they talking about the sort of Arthurian legends, and all of this comes to head in Henry's mind, and it really sets that tone for the adventurous, glamorous kingship that he's going to want to follow. Now, eventually this treaty is signed between Philip of Burgundy and Henry VII. They agree friendship and support for each other, and Philip agrees that de la Pole will be extradited to England on condition that he will not be executed. However, this all completely falls apart because about 6 months after landing in Spain, Philip of Burgundy dies of a fever. And that then means Catherine of Aragon is still of potential value and use in Henry VII's minds. So although this doesn't lead to a dramatic shift in foreign policy, the meeting is important for explaining and understanding a large part of Henry's style of kingship. Now, top of all these foreign policy shenanigans, Henry VII is also becoming increasingly paranoid about the succession. He's seen plots everywhere. He doesn't trust his own nobility or the merchants in London. And he also worries about the financial security of his position and that of the English throne. So he starts increasing taxes and using tax collecting lawyers to not only extract the maximum amount of money, but also to really, basically a kind of secret police, threatening and attacking nobles and dealing with any perceived opposition to Henry or threats to Henry. And the two lawyers that exemplified this were Richard Empsom and Edmund Dudley, who did everything on behalf of the king. They went independent, but they were absolutely hated because they were underhanded. They'd use blackmail, intimidation, and threats against nobles and against anyone with any money who may or may not have been plotting against Henry. But it's a culture of fear that Henry VII instills and uses them to carry it out. This divides his own council against him and basically means his last few years are ones of unpopularity for him and the Tudor dynasty. Again, this is going to explain a lot of Henry VIII's early actions once he becomes king. Henry VII is also routinely ill, and eventually in March 1509, he dies. Okay, it was kept secret for a few days because at this stage, Henry VIII is 17, which is still technically a minor. So that meant there would be a brief period of regency, which is always dangerous, and it raises the question of who's going to control the Regency Council and make decisions on the king's behalf. Now, the first thing that they have to do, they keep the death secret for a couple of days because they have to work out what's going to happen next. And the Regency Council, headed by Henry VIII's grandmother, Margaret Beaufort, basically come up with a plan where all the unpopularity from the last few years are going to be blamed on Empsom and Dudley. And that as soon as Henry VIII is proclaimed king, they are going to arrange for the arrest and execution of Empsom and Dudley, kind of suggesting that the old king had been a bit out of it and all the bad things were down to them. And this is to try and keep the peace because Henry VII had become so unpopular towards the end of his reign that there was every chance that rival claimants might rise up against this young king who was not yet in his full maturity. So that explains the execution of Empsom and Dudley. The other thing that happens, as soon as he becomes king, Henry makes sure he grabs the treasury. It's always important to have the cash. And then he starts restoring other Yorkist family members, who are his cousins in many ways, to positions of power and authority, kind of rewarding them for their loyalty. Now, obviously, Edmund de la Pole and Richard de la Pole don't get this, but another cousin, Margaret Pole, who is the Countess of Salisbury, and her sons, Henry, Reginald and Geoffrey, do get restored to lands and status. I say that because they will come back later in this story. Equally, another cousin of his, Henry Courtney, would be raised up as well and would eventually become the Marquess of Exeter and would be one of Henry's key young advisors and friends in the Privy Chamber in the early years of his reign. The other thing was to secure, well, to start securing the dynasty. And in some ways, we can look back and be surprised, but one of Henry VIII's first decisions within about 6 weeks of coming to the throne was to finally have a marriage, an official marriage to Catherine of Aragon. So remember, having repudiated it 4 years earlier, now he's going to stand up and say, no, I want a proper official marriage with Catherine of Aragon. At this stage, though, Catherine of Aragon is in her late 20s, and from a practical point of view, childbearing years, it's going to be a bit dodgy. You know, there's a lot of pressure that Henry could maybe find a better match, a more suitable match. Ferdinand's also getting on a bit here, so whether it's going to be the best strategic alliance he could get is also some debate. However, in some ways, it makes sense to marry Catherine. She's there. She's royal. She's princess of good royal stock. All the papal dispensations are there. He can marry her. The agreements are there. Doesn't have to wait wait for any treaties or negotiations. And basically can get straight on with trying to have a son. And that's really important and explains his rush there to marry Catherine because the Tudor dynasty is very limited and very weak, okay? He's got two sisters, Margaret and Mary. both of whom are married to English, the rivals of the English throne. Henry's got no other brothers. He's got no uncles left. He needs a son. And that explains his drive to marry Catherine of Aragon. And it will also explain later on his desperation to secure a male son later on. Well, you can't really have any. Well, to have a male heir, I should say, later on in the reign. And it's this obsession with securing the Tudor dynasty that drives him in most of his events during the 1520s and 1530s. Absolutely spurs him on. And we can see a taste of that here in 1509. And the last thing I'd just like to say here, just a little comment on that execution of Empsom and Dudley, sort of going back to that. Now, to be fair, Henry, although they were arrested straight away, Henry kept them locked up in the tower for about a year or so, torturing them and trying to get information. But what's telling is that Henry, and really it was Henry alone, who ordered their execution. Now, Empsom and Dudley had clearly enjoyed their jobs and had clearly been very unpopular, but they weren't traitors. Yet Henry trumped up charges and accused them of being traitors in order to have them executed to secure his own popularity. And while that certainly worked, it is a statement about the sort of person Henry VIII will be. Okay, these are people that served his father loyally. And rather than blame his father and rather sort of pardon them or forgive them, he has them executed for his own benefit. It's not obvious that this is going to be a regular pattern, but it does set the tone or show the type of person he was in 1509. And this is going to come out in very extreme ways during the 1530s and will explain that the young dynamic prince was really a mask for this tyrant that was underneath and was evident right from the word go. Anyway, that's the background to Henry VIII and him becoming king in 1509 and how he set his mark on the throne. Next time I do a Henry podcast, we'll be looking at the initial early years up 1513, looking at the foreign policy and relations with the Pope and others. But I hope that's been of interest and use to anyone studying Henry VIII. And if it's not, well, I'm very sorry that you've spent nearly half an hour listening to me. But hopefully there'll be something else that will be fun and enjoyable for you to do. And, you know, take care. Okay, that's enough from me. I really cannot find a good way to end a podcast. I need a catchphrase or something. Anyway, take care and I will speak to you again soon. Bye.